Okay, so we're diving deep today into a Supreme Court case, Samantar v. Yusuf, decided back in 2010. This case tackles like a truly fundamental question. Can individuals, and we're talking specifically former foreign officials, be held responsible, accountable in U.S. courts for really serious human rights abuses?
Right.
Or can they just, hide behind this concept of sovereign immunity? It's like we're trying to figure out, who gets that get out of jail free card in the world of international law when, terrible, terrible things have happened.
Yeah, and you really hit on the key tension here, right? You've got this well-established principle of sovereign immunity, which is, all about respecting the independence of different nations.
Right.
But then at the same time, you have this growing, I guess, global understanding that individuals should be held responsible when really serious human rights violations happen. So Samantar kind of throws these two principles right into the ring together.
Exactly. And the sources that you brought to the table today give us a really solid place to start. We've got some like guidance on how to even talk about this case, how to structure the narrative, hit the key points. Then we've got a super detailed breakdown of the case itself, like all the facts, the legal arguments, the court's decision, and then finally a concise legal brief that kind of sums up the core takeaways. So our goal here is to synthesize all of that, bring it all together so you get a clear picture of this really landmark ruling and why it matters even now.
Yeah, and it's important, I think, just to frame this right off the bat.
Yeah.
We're dealing with how actions of people in power in one country can have devastating consequences for people in another country or even in their own country.
Yeah.
And can those individuals then seek some kind of justice in another country's legal system? Samantar, this case, is a really, really crucial piece of that puzzle of international accountability.
Absolutely. And here's where it gets really, really interesting. So the central figure in all of this is Muhammad Ali Samantar, who held some incredibly powerful positions in Somalia back in the 1980s.
Right.
And the plaintiffs, in this case, they're Somali nationals, alleged that just horrific atrocities were committed under his command, while he was in these positions of power. But Samantar's defense was basically, well, hey, I was acting as a state official, therefore I should have immunity. I shouldn't be subject to being sued in U.S. courts. So you see that core conflict, right?
Yeah.
Sovereign immunity versus accountability for some very, very serious human rights abuses.
Right. And let's actually unpack those allegations a little bit because, you say horrific atrocities and that can mean a lot of things.
Right.
But, according to the case brief here, we know that Samantar served as Somalia's Minister of Defense. This was from 1980 to 86 and later as Prime Minister, 87 to 90. And the plaintiffs, who were primarily from a clan called the Isaac Clan, claimed that under his leadership, the Somali military engaged in just systematic atrocities. And we are talking about torture, extrajudicial killings, arbitrary detention, all part of what they allege was a campaign of persecution against this particular clan.
It's a very grim picture that emerges from these allegations. And it's an important detail that by the time these lawsuits were filed, Samantar was actually living here in the United States, in Virginia.
Right.
So you have the victims having fled Somalia after the collapse of the regime there, seeking to hold him accountable here legally, using tools like the Alien Tort Statute and the Torture Victim Protection Act. So really powerful legal tools.
Yeah, so given these really serious allegations, how did Samantar try to shield himself? How did he try to protect himself legally? Interestingly, his legal strategy wasn't really to deny the specifics of the allegations themselves. He wasn't saying, no, this didn't happen. He was basically saying, well, look, if these things happened, it was because I was acting in my official role.
Yeah.
I was a high-ranking government official, and therefore I should be protected. And the law that I should be protected under is the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, or what we call the FSIA.
Right. Which brings us to the kind of the core legal question at the heart of this case. Does the FSIA, which we tend to think of as, dealing with the immunity of states themselves, does it also extend to protect individuals like Samantar?
Right.
And initially, the district court actually sided with Samantar. They said, yeah, the FSIA, it does provide you with immunity. And so they dismissed the case.
But that was not the end of the story. I mean, right. I mean, that wasn't the final word. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals then stepped in and they reversed that ruling. And they basically said, no, the FSIA, it doesn't apply to individual foreign officials.
Right.
And, this is a really significant point because this created a split in how the law was being interpreted.
Right.
And that's, you know, part of what paves the way for the Supreme Court to take on a case like this.
Exactly. The Supreme Court then agreed to hear the case. They granted what's called certiorari, recognizing that this was a really big question. You know, what are the limits of the FSIA? You know, how far does this protection extend?
Mm-hmm.
And can individuals be shielded from accountability for things they did while in government? So, you know, it was a pivotal moment, a really crucial moment with huge, huge implications for, you know, how international law and human rights litigation might work here in the U.S.
So let's get to that decision and what it means, especially for, you know, for folks listening who are interested in this area of law. So Samantar Visev essentially carved out an important exception to this idea of sovereign immunity.
Okay.
The Supreme Court very clearly said, look, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which is designed to protect foreign states from lawsuits, it doesn't automatically also protect individual officials,
right,
even if they were acting in their official capacity at the time. So the big takeaway here is that this decision opened the door for victims of human rights abuses that were allegedly committed by foreign officials, to potentially seek some kind of justice, some kind of legal redress in U.S. courts.
Yeah.
And they could do this using laws like the Alien Tort Statute and the Torture Victim Protection Act.
Yeah, it's really interesting how the court kind of arrived at this conclusion.
Yeah.
They really focused on the specific language of the FSIA itself. Like, they looked very carefully at the definition of foreign state.
Mm-hmm.
And this is found in Section 1603 of the FSIA. And this definition, it lists a bunch of things, right? It talks about political subdivisions, agencies, instrumentalities of foreign state.
Right.
What's noticeably absent from that list is individual officials. And that was a key part of their reasoning.
Right. And, you know, if we zoom out a little bit, they also kind of looked at why was the FSIA created in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, what was the purpose? And they said, look, the main goal of this act was to establish a uniform framework, you know, a more clear-cut, legalistic way of handling disputes.
Right.
Especially commercial disputes that involve foreign states.
Yeah.
Rather than having it be sort of this ad hoc thing where the State Department's making decisions, mm-hmm, it was about creating more clarity.
Uh-huh.
And their focus was very much on the state as an entity, not on individuals who might be working for that state.
The court also emphasized what the legal situation was like before the FSIA was passed, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is back in 1976. And before that, the immunity of individual foreign officials, that was usually decided by the courts. And the courts often considered the views of the State Department. They would get these suggestions of immunity from the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
But the Supreme Court essentially said, look, the FSIA, when it came into being, it didn't completely erase this pre-existing way of handling immunity.
Yeah, so this raises a question then. If the FSIA doesn't apply to individual officials, well, then what does determine if they're immune?
Right.
You know, if they get sued in U.S. courts, are they automatically immune? And the court basically said, look, it goes back to those common law principles,
right,
you know, the principles that existed before the FSIA was passed.
Mm.
And what's interesting about this case, about Samantar's case specifically, is that there wasn't really a recognized government in Somalia at the time,
right,
to sort of formally say, hey, he's immune. We're vouching for him. So that complicated his defense even further.
So the Supreme Court's decision ultimately was unanimous. The FSIA does not govern the immunity of these individual foreign officials.
Right.
And they upheld the Fourth Circuit's decision to reverse the lower court.
Yeah.
But the legal journey, as you alluded to, it didn't end there.
Yeah.
Right? The Supreme Court then sent the case back down to the lower courts to figure out, okay, well, under these, you know, pre-existing common law principles, could Samantar still be entitled to some kind of immunity?
Exactly. And it's actually in those concurring opinions, right, you know, where the justices sort of give their own perspectives on the case, that we see some really fascinating legal reasoning. So Justice Stevens, who wrote the main opinion for the court, he leaned heavily on both the text of the FSIA and the purpose of the FSIA to conclude that it didn't apply to individuals.
Okay.
And he really reaffirmed that, look, common law principles still have a role to play here.
We also see some different perspectives emerging, particularly in the concurrences of Justices Scalia and Thomas, right?
Yeah.
They argued that the court only needed to look at the plain language of the FSIA itself to reach that conclusion, that it doesn't apply to individuals. they were less inclined to really delve into the legislative history, you know, the purpose and intent behind the act.
Right. They were much more textualists.
Right. Exactly. Just focus on the words themselves.
And Justice Alito, although he agreed with the outcome, you know, he agreed that the FSIA didn't apply to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
He stressed that those common law principles should take precedence, should be kind of the primary framework for deciding these cases.
Yeah. So if we kind of step back from those individual opinions, you know, these concurring opinions, they highlight a bigger debate that's always happening in the legal world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you interpret a law? How do you apply it to a particular situation?
Right.
And some justices, as you pointed out, they really prioritize a strict reading of the actual words of the law.
You know, what we call textualism, whereas others are more willing to consider the historical context. You know, what was happening when the law was passed, the intent behind it.
Right, right. It's a fascinating debate. So what actually happened after the Supreme Court sent the case back down?
Okay.
Yeah, back to the lower courts.
Yeah, well, so our case brief points out that, you know, on remand, Muhammad Ali Samantar actually admitted liability for the human rights abuses that the plaintiffs had accused him of. And following that admission, the district court entered a default judgment against him.
Oh, wow.
Awarding the plaintiffs a total of $21 million in damages.
Wow.
So, you know, it's one thing for the Supreme Court to clarify the law, to say, look, the FSIA doesn't apply in this way. But this really highlights that, you know, there's the potential for real accountability here.
Right.
You know, the victims of these horrific acts, they had a path, a legal avenue here in the U.S. to pursue justice.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the ripple effects of the Samantar decision have been pretty significant, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's opened the door for other lawsuits to be filed here in U.S. courts.
Right. Yeah.
Against former foreign officials accused of human rights abuses.
Right.
It strengthened the role of the Alien Tort Statute and the Torture Victim Protection Act.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really made a mark on how these cases are handled.
But, you know, one thing to keep in mind, one thing that often gets kind of overlooked in these conversations is that the State Department still has a role to play.
Right.
So even though the FSIA doesn't automatically grant immunity to individuals,
yeah.
The executive branch can still issue what are called suggestions of immunity
mm-hmm.
in specific cases.
Right.
And these suggestions, they can carry a lot of weight.
Yeah.
They can really influence how courts decide these cases.
Mm-hmm.
So this really points to the kind of the tension, the balance between legal accountability and U.S. foreign policy considerations.
That's such a complex, it's such a complex way.
Yeah.
And this brings up a really important question for everyone listening.
Mm.
You know, while Samantar really did create this opportunity for human rights litigation, you know, against these individuals, what are some of the real world practical challenges that you face when you actually try to pursue these cases?
Yeah. I mean, jurisdiction is a big one, right? I mean,
right, sure.
Does a U.S. court even have the authority to hear a case like this? Then you have to gather evidence. And that's a huge challenge, you know, if these alleged abuses happened in another country,
yeah.
potentially years ago,
right?
How do you even gather that evidence? And then even if you're successful, you know, even if you win a judgment like they did in Samantar, actually enforcing that judgment, actually getting any kind of compensation for the victims,
right, right.
That can be incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it's not like they can seize assets from, you know, from another country necessarily.
Right, right.
So that $21 million, while a symbolic victory, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
really raises questions about, you know, what was the real world impact for the plaintiffs?
Yeah, and I think for, you know, for folks who are really intrigued by this and want to delve deeper, I think it would be fascinating to look at how Samantar has been applied,
mm-hmm.
you know, in cases that have come after it.
Right.
You know, we've had other lawsuits against former foreign officials.
Yeah.
You know, how have the courts grappled with these really complex questions of jurisdiction and evidence? And, you know, what role has the State Department played? And also think about the ongoing debates about the Alien Tort Statute and the Torture Victim Protection Act.
Yeah.
These are really dynamic areas of law
yeah.
with huge, huge implications for international justice.
For instance, you know, you could look at instances where the State Department has issued a suggestion of immunity.
Mm-hmm.
In these cases that have come up after Samantar,
mm-hmm.
you know, how have the courts reacted to that?
Right.
It really underscores how complicated the relationship is between the different branches of government.
Yeah. When you're dealing with these really, really complex issues.
Yeah. And even, you know, even think about how other countries view cases like Samantar.
Right.
You know, you have U.S. courts asserting jurisdiction over officials from other nations.
Right, right.
How do they feel about that?
Right.
Is that, you know, does that raise issues of sovereignty? Does that create, you know, international tension?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It really touches on, you know, some fundamental principles of how different legal systems interact.
Exactly. Exactly. So as we wrap up, I think the key takeaway here is that Samantar v. Yusuf was a really significant moment, a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it clarified a key part of sovereign immunity, you know, how it applies or doesn't apply to individuals. But it also opened up this really complex legal landscape.
Right.
With so many challenges when you're actually seeking accountability for the worst human rights abuses.
Yeah, it didn't settle everything, but it definitely started a new chapter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In this conversation.
Well, thank you so much for bringing this case to our attention.
Oh, of course. Glad to unpack it with you.
It's been a fascinating deep dive. And to everyone listening, you know, keep exploring these issues.
Yeah.
You know, do your own research, think critically. It's a constantly evolving area of law.
Absolutely.
With really high stakes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll see you next time.
Sounds good.